Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Ira Flatow is away. Later in the hour, we'll discuss how Republican lawmakers are unraveling key environmental regulations put in place by the Obama administration and what President Trump is doing to weaken the EPA. But first, researchers working on creating the first artificial yeast genome have announced a milestone. They're now a third of the way there, having synthesized 6 of the 16 chromosomes, and they have a design ready for the rest. So, what's the big deal? Here to explain that, plus other short subjects in science, is Nick Stockton, reporter for Wired, based in San Francisco, California. Welcome back to Science Friday, Nick.
Hi, Manoush. Thank you.
Oh, it's good to hear your voice. Now, Nick, why would anyone want to synthesize yeast in the first place?
Well, first of all, it's cool. Yeast are a they're a eukaryote, which means they're a complex form of life, which includes everything from trees, mice, all the way up to humans. These are things with a distinct nucleus and also organelles inside the cell. But second, this is a very practical application. This strain of yeast is capable of gassing out various molecules that are used in like industry and food science. These include things like biofuels, medicines, industrial chemicals, and stuff like that. So that's why this one was engineered, because scientists wanted better control of what kind of molecules they could get these yeasts to gas out.
And so how close are we now to a fully synthetic yeast?
So they have designed 17 chromosomes, which is one more than wild yeasts have. They added a chromosome, which I can talk about in a second, but they have completed 6 of them. And that means that they have actually gotten the strands of molecule, turned them into strands of DNA, and then injected them into these cells. And they kind of have them holding off in pieces of yeast or bacteria, and they put those in coolers until they're ready to fully synthesize the entire yeast.
Now, when you say they, who are these yeast makers?
It is a bunch of theys. It is 500 scientists working in 10 labs across 4 continents.
Huh. So really like a international synthetic yeast conglomeration, if you were.
Yeah. And they, you know, as you can imagine, this is a huge undertaking. And so what they have is they have a data scientist working with them that created this workflow software. So nobody is stepping on anybody else's toes, and they're able to attack problems kind of in concerted effort.
Okay. So can I just ask, though, with synthetic yeast, does it have implications for more complicated kinds of life like us?
It could, yeah, eventually. You would have to go through a very complicated ethical review before you got to synthesizing human DNA. But yeah, potentially, if they can get this one working. I mean, yeast is, it's going to be complicated, but it's a little easier because yeast have this ability to, they can translate their DNA in a certain way that's not possible with other forms of eukaryotes. They have kind of like a special mutant power that makes it a little easier to work on.
Fascinating. Okay, so the next thing we want to talk about is the Tully monster. I have to make a confession that regular Science Friday listeners might find shocking. I had never heard of the Tully monster. What is it?
Right. I don't know if a lot of people have heard of it.
Oh,
it's
okay,
kind of
an
obsession of mine. I'm obsessed with them because I like weird little creatures. And unfortunately, this one's no longer with us. It's 300 million years old, these fossils. But imagine a squid body. And it has no tentacles. And where the eyes would be, you put big eye stalks sticking out to either side, and big googly eyes out there. And below and in front of those eyes, where you think there'd be a mouth, there's just a long articulated neck. And at the end of that is this beaky looking mouth with teeth, 8 of them on the top and bottom. And this thing is it's about a foot long. It's at the largest. And there's just this ongoing debate of which type of organism it is, whether it's a vertebrate or non-vertebrate. And that would have implications for which family of, you know, animals it falls into.
And don't keep us in suspense here. Is there an answer?
The latest science, which came out this week, says it's not an invertebrate. And this is going against the study that came out last year that said it was a vertebrate. And this is a little more complicated than just seeing if these fossils have a spinal cord or not. What they're looking for is other kind of these soft tissue things like that would indicate that it actually has a spinal cord and a central nervous system.
Okay, so your next story has some insights into how anti-science news, quote-unquote, spreads across the internet. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So this is a story that was reported out on BuzzFeed News by a reporter there named Stephanie Lee. And this is about, she looked into these ideologically bent news outlets that are building media fiefdoms on Facebook. And they're really focused on science. And the science they do is a lot of times false, misleading, or just misframed.
So, I mean, I'm fascinated by this because as the host of a tech podcast, Note to Self, we talk a lot about this idea of fake news and how it spreads. Does knowing where it comes from offer any advice for how to fight it then?
Potentially. I mean, this gets into these really, as I'm sure you've explored, these really sticky issues of trying to figure out how to get Facebook to deal with these, how news is used and how people spread information across their platform, which they are, you know, have been hesitant to address.
Yeah, this is a story that is not going to go away. And since we can't put it to bed now, I want to ask you about your last story, which is Runglish. What is Runglish, Nick?
Runglish is a portmanteau, which is two words put together, meaning it's from Russian and English. And so this is this hybrid language that is used on the International Space Station, which has a lot of astronauts and cosmonauts, which are Russian astronauts. And because they do training in both countries and because they have to communicate with each other and make sure that if anything goes wrong, they can get to it right away, they both have to learn, like all the Russian cosmonauts have to learn English and all the American astronauts have to learn Russian. And as a result of this, because neither of them are going to be perfectly fluent in the other language, they've kind of created this hybrid language called Runglish, which is in linguistic terms known as a Creole, which is a kind of language that forms when two other languages interact. And it has distinct traces of both.
I mean, is that different than whether there's like a first generation of living under one home and they sort of mishmash like Spanglish, I'm thinking of?
Yeah, kind of. I would probably get in trouble by linguists by going that far because there's different levels of it, like pidgins are some of these first generation ones, but Runglish is also spoken in places like Brighton Beach out in Brooklyn, where there's a huge Russian population.
Of course, that sounds great. You're making me hungry for pierogies. All right, thanks again. Nick Stockton is a reporter for Wired in San Francisco, California. Thank you, Nick.
You're welcome, Manoush, and have a great weekend.
You too. Okay, now it is time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. So it's a familiar element of some games. The longer you consistently play, the bigger boost you're going to get. There's that increasing payout of some casino games, the daily boost in Pokemon Go, or the extra fire arc icons that appear when you hit a long string of notes correctly in Rock Band. That type of game element is moving into the way we communicate, too, with features like Snapchat's Streaks. This is a reward for keeping up a Snapchat exchange with a special someone over a series of days. And here to talk about the good and bad of gamifying communications is Margaret Wallace. She's CEO of Playmatics, a game development company based in Brooklyn and San Francisco. Welcome back to Science Friday, Margaret.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So, okay, tell us, what is good about these gameplay features in communication apps like Snapchat? That is actually what my episode on the podcast is about this week.
Well, that's a great choice because, as you well know, Snapchat is really a banner service and application around these kinds of design elements. And so, for one, adding these very rote gamification elements is good for companies like Snapchat because it really enhances and amplifies community interactions that really strengthen their platform. But on the other hand, another good thing is that it also helps players or users potentially better articulate or understand how they relate to the world. It's just one way that designers show users sort of what their actions may imply, or even frequency. Even having that kind of feedback is really important, I think, for players or users to understand and put their actions into context.
And it's fun, right? But what is potentially bad here?
Well, you know, I always think of that episode from Black Mirror called Nosedive, which is basically about a future world not too far off in our future, perhaps, where everything in a person's life is dominated by how they're rated in social media. And that can create all sorts of potential anxieties. And we even see that today in the context of these social networks. For example, when a person is unfriended or blocked, it can really have a certain implication for someone who might really rely on that kind of communication for feedback or validation. So it's potentially tricky there in terms of trivializing and reducing our relationships to points and rewards and challenges.
I mean, I had read some research that said that teens were waking up in the morning and going through and sending streaks to all of their friends. And it wasn't so much about communicating with them. It was more like, don't drop the constant consistency, get the badge, get the points on Snapchat. But how do we teach them that that's not necessarily what friendship is about?
Yeah, because that social pressure can feel real. If you're on a snap streak that's 7 days long, you don't want to be the potential loser, quote unquote, who ends that streak. And I really think it's a matter of, I would say, social media literacy, social network literacy. It's something that I think we've all seen increasingly in our world, how important it is to really educate people to put social networks in the proper context of their world and their daily lives.
Are we seeing a lot of other types of communication using this sort of gameplay element? I mean, I think this might be one of the reasons why Snapchat's IPO was so high, because they knew that users were coming back, from what I understand, on average 18 times a day to Snapchat.
That's remarkable. Snapchat has done such a great job of including these kinds of features, and even things like surprises and random things that just pop up, which we, in the game industry, we call Easter eggs. And so we're seeing this in a lot of these networks, everything ranging from Twitter to LinkedIn to Fitbit to OkCupid. There are some kinds of elements in each of these services that touch on what we may call gamification, what they may call just good user experience design.
Margaret Wallace is CEO of Playmatics, a game development company based in Brooklyn and San Francisco. Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you. Have a great day.
When we come back, it's Trump versus the EPA, how the administration is quietly stripping the U.S. of its environmental policies. Stay with us.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. So last month, you may have seen a piece of proposed legislation go viral on Twitter and Facebook, H.R. 861. This was a bill to terminate the EPA. It's a classic example of stunt lawmaking, a flashy but toothless stand against environmental regulation, perhaps designed to distract us from more substantial threats. And that's because President Trump and Republican lawmakers don't need a single deadly bullet to kill the EPA. They can chip away at U.S. environmental policy in small, sometimes stealthy ways. For example, Congress has already overturned two Obama-era regulations involving methane emissions and coal waste through one rarely used law. And this week, newly appointed EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt says he'll consider throwing out a previous deal made with automakers to improve fuel economy standards. So here to tell us more about changes coming to the EPA and environmental regulation under the Trump administration are my two guests. Ann Carlson, Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA. Ann, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Manoush. Nice to be here.
And here in the studio with me is Michael Berger, Executive Director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. Michael, welcome to you.
Hello.
So if you have questions, listeners, you can give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Or you can tweet us directly at SciFry. So, Michael, I want to start with you. Let's start talking about what Congress is doing. They've rolled back these two environmental regulations so far. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the first regulation that Congress has undone under the Congressional Review Act is the Stream Protection Rule, which is a rule that EPA promulgated to eliminate waste dumping from coal mining sites. And, you know, in regards to climate change, that that rule sort of provides some incentive, increased incentive to coal companies to continue to operate without bearing the additional cost of controlling their pollution. And then, of course, it poses an immediate threat to waterways and the communities that live downstream from them.
Right. And then the other one is methane, right? Is that correct?
Well, the methane, the BLM methane rule has not formally gone. I don't believe that the Senate has actually voted to strike that rule down as of yet. The House passed a resolution under the Congressional Review Act, again, striking that down, but the Senate has not yet voted to do the same, and the Trump administration obviously hasn't acted on it.
Now, is it seems like it's just that easy to undo regulation. Is it?
Well, the Congressional Review Act is a unique body of legislation, and it basically provides Congress with the ability to overrule or repeal regulations that administrative agencies have passed within a certain period of time after they've passed. And, you know, in this instance, it's not all that easy. It needs to pass both houses of Congress, and then the president needs to sign off on it. It's only been successfully used once before prior to the current Congress.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
That was in 2001, I believe, when Congress rescinded a rule around ergonomics in the workplace.
Huh.
But there have been other attempts to use the rule to roll back, but typically you're not in a situation like this where you have Congress and a new president coming in a uniform party alignment to overturn the gross majority of the policies enacted by the former administration.
Right. So, Anne, are there other policies that they could overturn with the Congressional Review Act?
For the most part, the Congressional Review Act is, as Michael said, limited to regulations that were adopted very close to the end of the Obama administration. So what we're more likely to see is administrative rollbacks, that is, EPA using its authority to rescind rules that were previously adopted by the Obama administration. We could see Congress use other powers to try to curtail EPA power, but probably not under the Congressional Review Act.
And if something is pulled back, does that mean it's the end for those policies, or could a future EPA under another administration issue old rules again?
The answer is yes. An EPA that's friendlier to the environment could come in and reinstate more progressive environmental rules. It's also the case that, at least in theory, the Trump administration can't just not regulate. They will be sued if they don't issue replacement regulations. Mm. In fact, they'll probably be sued even if they replace regulations that are weaker than the ones that they pull back on. And they could lose. There are statutes that require EPA to protect the environment, to protect the air, to protect the water, to regulate on climate change. And so it's not like they have unbridled power that won't be checked by lawsuits and by courts.
So, Michael, from what I understand, the Republican lawmakers have also introduced the RAINS Act. This is another way to hamper regulation, especially at the EPA. Is that correct?
Well, it's not limited to the EPA. I mean, the RAINS Act is a proposal that's been around for a long time. I think that it was probably first introduced around a decade ago, if not longer ago. And the core idea here is to reconfigure the administrative state altogether. Mm. And what the RAINS Act would do basically is say that no rule that was passed by an administrative agency would take effect unless it was also agreed to by both houses of Congress and the president. Now, the president would likely sign that rule, but it would require both houses of Congress to vote on it. So what this does is it takes away the delegation of authority by Congress to the executive branch to regulate and to administer and to execute the law, mm-hmm. and says, well, we're going to give you the authority to develop proposals. And if we like that proposal, we'll adopt it and make it into law. And if we don't, then it's a wasted effort.
And that's it.
And that's it. And that would apply to EPA and every other agency.
Now, there's another one sort of menacingly called the Secret Science Reform Act. Can you tell us about that one?
You know, that one, I believe there's one provision of it which I'm familiar with, which basically says that the EPA agencies would only be able to rely on information that was publicly available in order to when they enact a regulation. And this could potentially gum up the works in regards to enacting public health regulations, some of which require rely on studies that use personal information,
protected private information. And how likely are either of these bills to become law?
You know, trying to figure out what Congress will do is, of course, a really tough guessing game. I think that there's one big protection, and that is that the Senate needs 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. And I think, certainly with the RAINS Act, I think with both of these, I think unless the filibuster disappears, Democrats will align and defeat these, assuming that the House of Representatives passes them and that the Senate then passes them. So I think the odds are relatively low, but this whole question of the viability of the filibuster, I think, is a big one, because I think a lot of policies could be affected by the presence of Democrats in the Senate who can stop the most radical bills from passing if they choose to exercise their filibuster power.
Okay, so that's Congress. Let's go over to the executive branch. President Trump, he's also using executive action to dismantle climate change policy. He's announced that as soon as next week, he'll order the EPA to withdraw its Clean Power Plan. What is that, and why would he want that on the chopping block, Anne?
The Clean Power Plan was issued under the Clean Air Act, actually as the result of a lawsuit that first began against the George W. Bush administration and then continued, the effects of it continued under the Obama administration. And it attempts to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector. The electricity sector is now the second biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the country, surpassed only by the transportation sector. And it's a pretty ambitious proposal to try to cut about 30% of the emissions of the electricity sector by 2030, and it does so in a novel way. It's under court challenge right now, and President Trump has made very clear that he's going to repeal it.
So, Michael, how does this work, though? Didn't things get complicated because the Supreme Court ruling gave the EPA the authority to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, right? There's all sorts of different branches who have formalized things.
Yeah, this gets into some pretty murky waters pretty quickly. You know, one of the things that we learned yesterday was that the executive order that we expect to see next week that Anne referred to, we expect that it'll say not just that EPA should repeal the existing rule, but also that it shouldn't even offer up a new rule to take its place. And that's fundamentally different than saying we're going to repeal this rule, look at the policy preferences and mm-hmm. choices that went into it, and come up with something new that, like Anne said earlier, would be maybe weaker. That's consistent with what we also heard from EPA Administrator Pruitt yesterday, that he doesn't appear to believe that carbon dioxide is a significant contributor to climate change that we're seeing today. And that, in turn, does get to this sort of core issue that you're raising, which is the Clean Air Act, requires regulation of air pollutants that endanger the public health and welfare. And one of the outcomes of the litigation that Anne mentioned was that EPA reached the determination that it does, that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions are air pollutants that endanger our public health and welfare. And the consensus science view today, of course, is that that is true. It is obvious. So we're now in a situation where the head environmental protection representative in this country doesn't agree with the fundamentals of climate science and intends to not just reconsider policy, but just to take no action whatsoever.
So, Anne, Scott Pruitt, this new head of the EPA, he also has an eye on something called the CAFE regulations. There's so many regulations, so many names. These are fuel efficiency standards that President Obama negotiated with the car industry. What's happening there?
So the fuel economy standards are issued under both the Clean Air Act, as we've already talked about, and also a separate federal statute. And they go after the biggest emitting sector, the biggest greenhouse gas emitting sector, and that is the transportation sector. And basically what they do is get us on a path toward much more efficient vehicles. And the rules in particular that Pruitt is going to go after are for model years 2022 to 2025. At least that's what we're hearing. We don't know whether he's going to eliminate those rules altogether or just make them easier to meet. And then there's a really complicated related question, which is whether he's also going to take away authority from California, who has the power under the Clean Air Act to issue its own standards.
We got a tweet from Aaliyah with a question for both of you. How likely is it that the Trump administration dissolves the EPA entirely? Anne, do you want to take that first?
Sure. I think that it's very unlikely, but it's attempting to really gut EPA in all kinds of ways, and in particular in terms of funding. The difficulty in doing away with EPA altogether is that there are a bunch of statutes on the books that require EPA to do things, to issue regulations, to enforce laws, to clean up hazardous waste sites, and so forth. And so if you abolish the agency, you'd have to presumably also amend all those statutes to take EPA authority away. And that would be just a big political mess, and it'd be really, really difficult. So I think what they're basically trying to do is kill EPA through a thousand cuts as opposed to actually abolishing it outright.
Right. Michael, you agree?
Absolutely. And another way that they're going about this is by putting into positions of authority within the agency people who, like our administrator, are fundamentally opposed to the mission of the agency, and who, rather than seeking to find ways to constructively regulate industry to protect the public health and welfare and the environment, are seeking ways to not do that.
I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Anne. Let me just mark where we are. I'm Manoush Zomorodi.
Sure.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Anne, you wanted to add something to what Michael was saying.
Yeah, I was going to say this seems consistent with Steve Bannon's phrase that he wants to deconstruct the administrative state.
Right. No. I'm talking to Anne Carlson, Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA, and Michael Berger, Executive Director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. Anne, you mentioned this sort of putting away at the EPA by a thousand cuts. Is that sort of is a good demonstration of that Trump's proposal to slash the EPA budget and eliminate 38 of its programs?
Absolutely. I mean, these cuts are so draconian that we'd see the essential elimination of all kinds of programs that do things like clean the Chesapeake Bay, clean the Great Lakes, remove or clean up diesel vehicles which emit cancer-causing particulate matter. And in addition, to gut both enforcement staff, that is those lawyers and staff people who administer the law and make sure that polluters are actually following it, along with the very committed scientists, economists, lawyers, and other staff who issue the regulations under the statute. So they're just gutting them. There's going to be, if Trump succeeds, there's going to be essentially no one left to administer the laws, to clean up the environmental messes that still remain, and to figure out how to move forward and continue to make environmental progress in cleaning the air, cleaning the water, and protecting the planet from higher temperatures.
So I would just add to Anne's excellent points that, first, these are very popular programs in many instances,
yeah.
And the Trump proposed budget is not the final word on what the budget will actually be. So, you know, there is a lot of, I think, work to be done as the appropriations process moves forward in Congress to remind Congress people that environmental protection enjoys broad and deep popular support. The second thing that I would mention is that these budget cuts that have been proposed are not unique to EPA. They are, you know, across many agencies, including many other agencies that have direct relevance to our climate future. One of the things that the Trump administration has proposed to do is to cut all funding altogether for floodplain mapping. Floodplain mapping is the way in which the Federal Emergency Management Agency helps us know who's at risk of floods, both from sea level rise and storm surge and increased flooding from severe storms and extreme precipitation events. They also want to cut funding for disaster planning and for disaster recovery. Now, it's, you know, when we think about climate change, we often think about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But climate impacts are happening now, right. And adaptation measures are necessary. And what they're proposing to do is to undercut state and local efforts to be prepared for impacts that are already happening and are definitely locked in for the future.
I mean, I just wonder how that plays out politically. I mean, it takes one Hurricane Sandy for people to say, wait, whoa, 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 where did our funding go? Right, Anne?
Absolutely. I think Michael made a great point earlier about the fact that these budget cuts are only proposals at this point. They haven't passed Congress. And it remains to be seen whether Congress is willing to sign on to what I agree will be really unpopular moves. Disaster planning, let me add a couple more.
Yeah.
I mean, the budget currently contemplates drastically cutting the NASA budget to figure out what's going on with respect to climate change, the building of scientific knowledge about how to address climate change, about how to address the emissions that are causing temperatures to rise. It devastates the Department of Energy's budget. Department of Energy has lots of programs focused on clean energy, energy efficiency, et cetera. All of these are very popular, and they're not just popular in blue states. They're popular across the country. President Trump himself said that he believes in clean air and clean water, and yet his budget does not display any love for either of those topics.
Okay. And Michael, don't go away. We're going to come back in just a second. We're going to talk more about regulation, the EPA, the Trump administration. We'll be right back after this very short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Anoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about changes already underway at the EPA. And my guests are Anne Carlson, Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA, and Michael Berger, Executive Director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. And I want to just take a call. We have someone on the line. Let's see if I can do this right. Sarah calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Sarah, hey, it's Manoush here. Do you have a question?
Hi, Manoush. Yes, this morning I read in the Washington Post online a headline about 21 children filing a lawsuit that would have a significant impact on Trump and his administration's ability to mess with our environment. Can you say more about what's happening with that lawsuit?
Yeah, let's ask Michael and Anne. Michael, you want to go first?
Sure. So this is a lawsuit that was filed by 21 youth plaintiffs in federal district court in Oregon that is really a novel and potentially groundbreaking lawsuit. Basically, what the kids in the case have claimed is that, first, that there's a constitutional right that's at stake in climate protection, which is a statement that's never been held true before by the courts. Second, that there's a public trust obligation that the federal government owes to the people of the United States and to future generations to ensure that the nation's natural resources and its regulatory authority are managed in such a way as to protect current and future generations. So they sued the Obama administration and basically asked the court to step in and set a science-based target for greenhouse gas emissions and for management of our natural resources in a way consistent with those science-based targets. Where that lawsuit is right now, the defendants, the U.S. government, and various industry groups that have intervened in the case filed a motion to dismiss the case. The district court judge denied that motion, so it is moving forward towards a trial. But in the meantime, the federal government actually this week just filed a motion to sort of stop the litigation where it is and have the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the appellate court, weigh in on whether or not the district court was right to allow the case to move forward.
Great question, Sarah. Thanks for bringing that to our attention.
Well,
did you want to ask? Yeah, go for it.
In follow-up, I think the Post, one of the highlights of their article, and I scanned it really quickly, was essentially that the folks who were contesting this essentially said the burden of proof shouldn't be on the government. Some element of a different strategy, you know, this is a new strategy and that shouldn't be. Is that?
Interesting.
Well, one of the things that is very exciting about this lawsuit is the idea that there are constitutional and this public trust basis that really should govern the way in which the government acts here, that it's not just a matter of the Clean Air Act and what the EPA can or can't do under the under that statute, but that there actually are other sort of more fundamental rights at stake. And the district court judge found that there is such a constitutional right and that there is a public trust obligation, both of which are entirely innovative holdings, which is presumably why the U.S. government is seeking to have the appellate court hear those issues now.
So, Anne, I mean, of all the moves that have been made so far to deregulate or weaken the EPA, what do you think could be the most damaging in the long term?
I think the passage of the RAINS Act would be, in the long term, really, really deleterious, because not only would it hamper environmental progress under a Trump administration, but it would still be in effect for a new administration that comes in that wants to be more environmentally protective. And Congress would need to approve any regulation that imposes costs greater than $100 million. That means essentially any major environmental regulation. I mean, just to give you one example, a rule that protects the population from mercury emitted from coal-fired power plants has costs of about $9 billion, but it also has benefits in the tens of billions mm-hmm. of dollars from the protection of public health. That would never have passed a Republican Congress, and we wouldn't have that rule in place. So for me, I think anything that Congress does to permanently curtail EPA authority is probably the most damaging. I'd say second would be really, really draconian budget cuts that we don't get back or that get hard to replace. So if we see the kinds of budget cuts that the Trump administration is proposing, 25-30% of the budget, we're just going to devastate enforcement and protection across the country. And particularly if we see other budget cuts that affect states, it's very hard for states to step in and fill the void.
Okay, I want to take another call after that depressing comment. I want to go
sorry.
To... No. Marge is calling from Washington, D.C. Marge, is that right that you're a former EPA employee?
Yes, I am.
Tell us your question.
Well, it's more of a comment. I think that with Scott Pruitt saying that he's very uncertain about whether carbon dioxide is a major contributor to climate change, he is hiding behind uncertainty as opposed to bad science. There's uncertainty in every scientific endeavor, and particularly in modeling. I actually used to do modeling for EPA. It wasn't climate work, but it was ecosystem modeling. And there's lots of uncertainty. There's lots of variability, but that doesn't. It's kind of like, to me, his saying, "Well, we're not going to do anything," is kind of like saying, "I've got a kid who's got a fever, but I don't know whether it's 100 or 104, and I'm not going to do anything until I know which one of those things."
Marge, are you in touch with any of your former colleagues? I'm kind of wondering what morale is like.
Morale is in the toilet. I haven't been closely in touch, but what little I have been, it's in the toilet. I was actually in the Office of Science and Technology, and they're the ones that mission statement no longer mentions science.
Oh, gosh. Thank you for calling in, Marge. We appreciate it very much. I mean, Michael, when you're listening to this, what can people actually do? You've built an online climate deregulation tracker that helps people sort of keep track of what is going on day by day. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So quickly on the tracker, which is available on the Sabin Center's website, www.columbiaclimatelaw.com, what we've done there is we've put up a sort of front page tool that literally does keep track of the deregulatory efforts being undertaken both by the administration through the executive branches, the executive agencies, and by Congress. And then we've linked that through to a database that we've created of existing climate regulations that were passed during the Obama administration. So you can sort of see side by side what's already on the books and what are they doing now? How are they trying to dismantle this thing? In terms of how to use that information, there are several fairly traditional, avenues, I think, that are available. One is to engage with the administrative agencies. As Anne mentioned earlier, when an agency pulls back on a final rule, they don't get to just say, we're done with it. They actually have to go through a regulatory process, which involves providing public notice and allowing for public comment. And, you know,
so public.
Yes.
Keep track. Have comments.
Exactly so. And then at the same time, a lot of this is quite political. I think that a lot of what we've been talking about today reflects this sort of shift away from faith and reliance on technical and scientific expertise, which is manifested in the agencies, and a move towards political decision making in these areas that really ought to be left to experts. And so there's a lot to be done in regards to pushing politicians to allow the experts to exercise their expertise. Exactly.
And very briefly, I just want to give you the last word. Could anything good come out of any of this? Are there some legitimate improvements to be made at the EPA?
So I'm going to be more global about what good could come out of this. And this actually is a follow-on to some of the comments Michael made about how people can get involved. One thing to do is to look at states. And a number of states are doing really innovative things in the clean energy sector, including not just the blue states, but red states. So get your state legislators to support renewable energy, other clean energy moves, and also support environmental organizations, those non-governmental organizations that actually can keep track of a lot of the regulation, can make comments. Places like the Sierra Club and the NRDC and local organizations and organizations focused on environmental justice. I think getting the public engaged in the process is one of the few things that I think is a bright spot here. I think people do care about the environment, and they need to express how much they care about it. And you know what? Congress listens to that. So another, place to really pressure is when these budget cuts get presented to Congress. And if you're in a district where your congressman is thinking about supporting them, call. Right. Make it clear that clean air and clean water and climate change matter to you.
Yeah.
We have seen actually the growth of a Republican climate caucus. So,
and we got to leave it there.
Very, very slow shifts. Okay.
Great,
I could go on.
Great advice. Such good information. Ann Carlson Shapiro, professor of environmental law at UCLA. Michael Berger, executive director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you.
Okay, now for something completely different. In Central Asia, the remote steppe is filled with sounds of the blowing wind and grazing animals. But Tuva, a republic sandwiched between Siberia and Mongolia, is known for a different sound. That's Tuvan throat singing. So yes, you heard a stringed instrument, but all those other notes are made by one person. He is singing two notes at one time. How does he do it? Well, that is the topic of our latest Macroscope video series, and SciFry's video producer Luke Groskin is here to talk about it.
Hi, Manish.
Hey, Luke. And Aaron Johnson is a speech and language pathologist at NYU's Voice Center. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, nice to be here.
Okay, so Luke, there are different types of this polyphonic, as it's called, singing. What is unique about Tuvan throat singing?
Well, Tuvan throat singing is really deeply rooted in the culture of Tuva. So if you listen to it, listen to that, there's this whistling noise, and that noise is meant to kind of mimic the sounds of the wind on the steppe, the Tuvan steppe. And there's also a lot of kind of cowboy sounds there. There's like a kind of galloping feel to it. Some of the styles sound a little bit like animals. And it's all meant to kind of replicate the sound and emotions and feelings of being out there living a nomadic lifestyle in a yurt and riding a lot of horses.
I'm Manoush Samarodi, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, so Aaron... let's play a clip of this Tuvan throat singing. We have a clip of the high style. Can we hear that? It's amazing. It's mesmerizing. When you sing one note, aren't you technically singing a bunch of notes? So what are throat singers doing to get this two distinct note effect?
Yeah, that's right. So you said that they're singing two notes. Then the truth is exactly that every time that we use our voice, we have a fundamental frequency. Our vocal folds are vibrating so many times per second, and that's the pitch that we hear. And there are many overtones or harmonics that are produced as well that are multiples of that fundamental frequency. So we all do that. The difference with the Tuvan throat singing is that they're able to amplify certain of those harmonics to produce what sounds like a unique pitch. So we're all producing it, but they're making adjustments within the tube above the larynx, above the vocal folds, mm-hmm. which is the back of the throat and the space in the mouth. And by adjusting the lips and the height of the larynx, which is where the vocal folds are, and changing the tongue position, they can then resonate and amplify that harmonic, which then again sounds as a separate pitch that's happening.
It's vocal contortions.
It is.
And we should say, Luke, that what we're listening to is the band that you interviewed, Alash. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. Those are the members of the band Alash. They've been going on tour across the U.S. They're pretty famous, especially in Russia.
Okay, and they from is again, is it three different kinds of Tuvan throat singing
yeah,
that they
there are.
Do? Is that right?
That was Sijit, and then there's a middle style, Hume, and then there's a low style, which is my favorite, which is called Kagara, and that one sounds a little bit like a frog is singing inside of your throat.
We actually have a clip of it. Let's play the low one. What's going on there?
It's kind of like a Russian bass. It's a very low sound. That particular note, the fundamental, is around a low B, which is very low. And then, again, it's a similar idea where harmonics are being amplified, and we have this drone that's very low, and then the harmonics, which sound like a melody, above that. And it could be a different part of the larynx that's actually vibrating in that sound. There's a little bit of knowledge of looking down the throat and seeing what's vibrating there. And there's two different sets of tissue. There's the vocal folds I'm talking with now, we all talk with, which are called the true vocal folds.
Yeah.
And then there's some folds of tissue just above there called the false vocal folds or the ventricular vocal folds. And it's likely that those are being engaged to produce that very low and a kind of raspy, rough sound.
How many Science Friday listeners do you want to bet are trying to do it right now in their cars or in their kitchens? Are we going to hurt ourselves if we try to do Tuvan throat singing?
Unlikely. It's the ventricular vocal folds that are likely vibrating in the low, not really designed to vibrate, which is why they create that kind of a rough sound. But it's unlikely you're going to hurt yourself. And in playing around with the voice and seeing what different kinds of sounds you can make is exactly the way to learn to do something like this. And really, the way we learn to sing in any style is by playing around and trying different
right.
ways of using our voice.
So, Luke, you saw the pros at work. Are they laboring to do this, or is this something that they just sit there and make all these?
For some of the styles that are more intensive, like the high style, when the guys are like flowing through different melodies, you can see there's sweat forming on their brows. They're really working hard to squeeze certain parts of their throat and manipulate their lips exactly the way they want to. It really reminded me a lot of somewhere between, an opera singer that has, incredible, profound craft and is really working hard and, a blues singer where they're pulling stuff out of their soul in order to communicate.
So cool. All right. Listeners, you must watch Luke's latest video and hear a track from the band Alash. Also, Aaron, you are in the video really showing us how the vocal cords work. You put a microscope or a little camera down mm-hmm. a throat of another singer and show us. It is fascinating and beautiful to listen to and to watch. Go check it out at sciencefriday.com/Tuvan, T-U-V-A-N. Thank you both so much for being here. Aaron Johnson is a speech and language pathologist at NYU's Voice Center.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke Groskin is Sci-Fi's video producer. I'll see you after the show, Luke.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers. At the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.